I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. The 2018 election season is beginning to heat up. The filing deadline for a place on the ballot in the June primary is tonight at 9 o'clock. Most of the 7 Democratic candidates for governor are apparently looking for gender and geographic diversity in their choices of running mates. 4 of the candidates have never held elective office before. Larry Hogan and Boyd Rutherford were also newcomers to elected office when they became only the 2nd Republican ticket to win the governorship in Maryland in the last 50 years. Hogan is the 2nd most popular governor in the country. Do the Dems have what it takes to unseat him in November? Today, a look at the field of Democratic governor wannabes with Ovita Wiggins of The Washington Post, Malia Cromer of Goucher College, and William Zorzi of Maryland Matters. First, the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. 7 candidates have declared their candidacy for the 2018 election for Maryland governor. Prince George's County Executive Rashern Baker's wellspring of support from the Maryland Democratic Party and name recognition amongst prospective Maryland voters have propelled him to an early lead with emphasis on the early. He is followed by former head of the NAACP Ben Jealous and Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz. The only female candidate at the top of a ticket in this year's contest is Krish Vignaraja, who served as policy director for former First Lady Michelle Obama, but the field of lieutenant governor candidates includes several women. Some analysts predict record-breaking voter turnout nationwide for these midterm elections, citing Democrats' distaste for Donald Trump as a big motivator. Republican Governor Larry Hogan has assiduously tried to distance himself from President Trump. He has a very high approval rating, that's Governor Hogan, that is. And by the time the general election campaign begins after the June primary, Hogan is expected to have as much as $10 million in his campaign coffers. The challenge for Maryland Democrats: choose a contender amongst the 7 primary candidates who can unseat the popular Republican governor. The filing deadline to be on the ballot in June is tonight at 9 o'clock. Today on Midday, we size up the candidates. Joining me in Studio A, Dr. Malia Cromer. She's a pollster, an associate professor and director of the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center at Goucher College. Good to see you again. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And William Zorzi is a reporter from Maryland Matters, where he covers state politics. Bill, good to have you as well.
Nice to be here.
And on the phone from Washington, D.C., Ovita Wiggins. She covers Maryland politics and government for The Washington Post. Hi, Ovita. Welcome to Midday.
Hi. I'm in Annapolis, but thanks for having me.
Oh, Annapolis, right? You know, it's the same as Washington, only smaller.
Yes. Right?
Well, thank you for your time. I appreciate it. If you would like to join us, listeners, you are welcome to 410-662-8780 with your predictions, your predilections for the governor's race and other races coming up in this 2018 midterm election. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to find us on Twitter at @MiddayWYPR, and we are streaming live on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Ovita Wiggins, your take on the early polls that you've heard about, you know, that do have Rashern Baker at the moment as the one to beat. You've covered some people who've taken Mr. Baker to task for certain things having to do with some education policies and stories in Prince George's County, where he's the county executive. What do you think? Is Baker the guy that everybody's gunning for at the moment?
I think, well, obviously he is at the top right now. As you said, it's very early, and as the polls have shown, there are so many people who say they don't know enough about the candidates at this point. I think it's like 44% have no preference. But Rashern Baker will have, you know, he's been in office for almost 8 years, so he will have to defend his record when it comes to education, when it comes to, you know, most people think of Prince George's and they think of the, you know, the corruption of Jack Johnson, so he'll have to talk about that, what he's done to try and turn that around in the county. So he will have to defend his record as he sort of tries to move into this next position.
And Malia Cromer, Goucher just issued a bunch of polls about a number of different topics. One of them was about political ideology. What did you find that voters said, you know, were the ways that they were self-describing themselves?
So we looked at this number among Maryland Democratic likely voters, and what you see is this really interesting split between those individuals who identify themselves as progressives and those Democratic likely voters who say they're moderates. And I think this adds a really interesting contour to this race, because it seems to me right now that all the candidates in the race are really fighting for that progressive part of the base. They self-identify as progressives, they talk about progressive values, but a large portion of that Democratic electorate identifies themselves as moderates. So I think it'll be interesting to see how they shift throughout the campaign season if they start to try to go after that more moderate part of the Democratic base.
And Bill Zorzi, what does that mean, number one, for the seven candidates who've lined up to be on the primary ballot in June to go up against Mr. Hogan? And what does that mean for Mr. Hogan, the number of people saying they're progressive versus moderate? And does that favor a candidate or two in the current field?
Ordinarily, I would say it doesn't. Without the Donald Trump factor, I would say that it wouldn't have any effect. I think it's difficult to predict what effect that might have at the moment. There are people like Ben Jealous, who is a Democratic candidate for governor, who has, got an early endorsement from Bernie Sanders. Whether that translates to anything, I don't know. I see it as I'm not sure I see any ideological lineup mm-hmm. the way others might.
And Ovita Wiggins, is the base of support that County Executive Baker has in Prince George's County, animated by the progressive wing of the party, or has he been a government official who has reached out and appealed to both moderates and progressives on that side of the Democratic Party?
I think with Rashawn Baker, most of his support has been establishment Democrats. He obviously has gotten the support. When you look outside of Prince George's County, he's gotten the support of Brian Frosch. He's gotten the support of Senator Van Hollen, the support of Montgomery County Executive Ike Leggett. He probably would describe himself more as a moderate versus a progressive. But yet he does appeal to both.
And Malia Cromer, the big winner in your poll in terms of who's most favored at the moment is none of the above or I don't know yet, right? I mean, the people who are undecided are way outnumber the people who have made a choice at this juncture.
No, you're absolutely right. And so I think that's why, we can point to Rashawn Baker, and he certainly has gained more name recognition than the rest. And we can point to Kevin Kamenetz, as well as Ben Jealous, as starting to break away slightly from the pack. But with that many undecided voters, there is still a ton of room for there to be some serious fluctuations. Back to the point about being the progressive issues, I think it's important to bring up how I think the minimum wage will be that economic test of progressive, of your kind of progressive credentials in this election cycle. So we also asked about the minimum wage, and it's really popular among Democrats, and it has come up in every one of the forums. And so every single one of the candidates have had to basically take a pledge that they support that $15 minimum wage.
And Ovita Wiggins, where does that bill stand in the Annapolis State House at the moment?
Actually, it's in committee. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be taken up later this week.
But you do expect a vote sometime this session. They're not going to punt this one.
That I would not bet either way mm-hmm. at this point. The Senate President Miller was actually asked about that today, and he would not say where he stands on the issue. Instead, he said that, it's in committee.
Yeah. And Bill Zorzi, of course, you know, everything that the folks in the General Assembly are considering now is, you know, done under this patina of consideration of the fact that this is an election year. What about the geography of the state? We've had now a governor who is not from Baltimore. There are a lot of people who point to the governor with some disdain, saying that he has kind of dissed Baltimore. He canned the red line. He has delayed the development of State Center. He has his reasons for doing that, and there are a lot of people who agree with his reasons for that. But what about the fact that, for example, Kamenetz, Alec Ross, who lives here in Baltimore, perhaps even Ben Jealous, you know, who as the former director of the NAACP based in Baltimore, is considered a Baltimore candidate as opposed to, you know, Rich Modaleno from Montgomery County or Rashern Baker or Vish Vignaraja, you know, from outside Baltimore. How is the Baltimore-ness of this campaign going to play out?
I'm not really sure, to be honest with you. I hate to sound so vague on all these questions that you're putting to me, but it does feel very much early yet. And, you know, I just want to sort of caution listeners and everybody else involved here that, you know, putting Rashern Baker out there as the man to beat might be a little premature.
Mm-hmm. I mean, sure. Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, I think in the Gallup poll, he only barely made
20%, barely. Yeah.
Okay, so.
Yeah, that's not a lot. That's not a lot. And you know, the winner of this race, as several people have pointed out in the primary, with a field that crowded, you know, only needs to get about 30% of the vote to actually win, Malia, right? I mean, so this is doable for all seven of them.
Well, I think it's absolutely doable for all seven of them, except for the fact that they really need to start distinguishing themselves from one another. So if you pay attention to any of the sort of messaging and the forums that have happened from when they all got in, it's a heavy focus on opposition to Hogan and then opposition to Trump. What we really haven't seen yet, and which is what I'm really interested in, is when they start to really talk about each other's records and really try to compare and contrast. And I'm not saying get nasty. I'm saying really start to put each other in their own policy positions as the central part of the campaign moving forward. So I think we understand that they're all against Larry Hogan and they're all against Donald Trump, but they have to make it through the primary first.
Yeah, and Ovita Wiggins at a recent forum here in Baltimore, all seven of them committed to voting and supporting whoever the candidate was. We never had any of that, you know, back and forth about, oh, no, I'm the only one. They all agree certainly on that, as Malia says. You talk about Rashern Baker's record because he has been an office holder now for 8 years. Kevin Kamenetz also has a record that will be scrutinized. How do you assess the importance of the insider-outsider distinction between these candidates? You've got Kamenetz and Baker, you've got Rich Modaleno, who've held political office, and then you've got the other four who have not, making the case that really that Larry Hogan made 4 years ago, saying what we need is a fresh look, a non-politician look at the governorship. How do you think that issue is going to play out in this particular race?
Well, I would say at this point, I hate to sound like Bill Zorzi, but it is early to know how that's going to play out. I mean, obviously, of the four that you mentioned who do not have any have never been elected to office before, Ben Jealous has sort of separated himself a little bit from the pack. But it is still early. Jim Shea has raised more money that he sort of surprised many by the amount of money that he raised.
And he's another Baltimore-based candidate, very prominent lawyer here.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. And then you also, and as you mentioned, you have Rich Modaleno, who is basically describing himself during these forums as the one who's in state government now, who's in state elected office now and knows about the budget, unlike the four who have never run before or who have never held elected office before. So it will be interesting to see how it does play out as we get closer to the primary.
Bill Zorzi?
Tom, if I could just jump in a second. I have to tell you that I find it a little disingenuous that Governor Hogan, the last time out, was saying it was sort of time for a non-political player. he sort of grew up in a very political family.
Yeah, his father was in Congress, for God's sake.
And a nice man, by the way. And he also was Governor Ehrlich's appointment secretary. Mm-hmm. And that's not the guy who keeps the calendar. That's the guy who
makes the appointments.
That's correct.
Or recommends making the appointments.
Right.
A variety of statewide commissions and offices. Sure.
Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of jobs. The green bag and more. The other thing that I wanted to mention was, and I hate to sort of get to the nuts and bolts of it, but cabinets and Rusher and Baker both have some sort of organization on the ground, which will help them. And Jim Shea has, by putting his arms around Brandon Scott, to a certain degree, who was a Baltimore City councilman, will have the benefit of some sort of ground game or organization on come election day, at least in the city of Baltimore.
Mm-hmm. Brandon Scott thought to be an up and comer in the Democratic Party. A lot of folks think he has his eye on the mayor's office of Baltimore. This could be a very very big boost to his career.
Oh, it's absolutely. I mean, this is a free pass for him. I mean, he gets to run, unlike others who are challenging members of the legislature for their Senate seats or whatever.
Yeah, he doesn't have to resign from the city council to do this.
Right.
Right.
Like Rich Mattolino will have to do from the state Senate, which I think will be actually a loss for the Senate.
Emilia Cromer, speaking of Brandon Scott, who's one of many lieutenant governor picks that has been announced in the last couple of weeks, the only one who hasn't announced is Karishma Narajah. I spoke to her campaign earlier today. They have to make that announcement today because today's the filing deadline, and you can't file to run for governor on the June primary ballot without announcing your pick. They said they weren't going to do that by 1 o'clock this afternoon, but they will do it sometime this afternoon, so we'll let you know when we find out. But how did it strike you, the field of lieutenant governor candidates?
I think there was a lot of lot of standouts. So there has been a lot of criticism from this flock of Democratic candidates that they were unable to get anybody to quote unquote give up their seats to run with them. And Republicans will speculate that's because they're afraid of the kind of power of the Hogan candidacy. But what we do have is a lot of, I think, really strong picks. I think particularly Elizabeth Embry is somebody I look at and say, and that's Baker's pick, who made a lot of inroads with Baltimore City voters when she ran for mayor. I think that although she didn't do that well in terms of electoral votes, I think that people walked away with that campaign with a positive image of her. Now the name is slipping out of my mind. Kevin Kamenetz is running mate.
Valerie Irwin.
Thank you. I think Valerie Irwin is a fantastic pick because she balances out some of the things that Kevin Kamenetz's own strengths and weaknesses. She's a gregarious person, warm. She has progressive roots in a really important geographic area that he needs to do well in. And I think she'll be a fierce competitor.
He's from Baltimore County. She's from Montgomery County.
And I think she'll
just be, Rashern Baker from Prince George's County, Elizabeth Embry from the city.
And in both of their cases, I think Embry as well as Valerie Irwin will be really great on the campaign trail.
Yeah, and Oviedo Wiggins, what does it strike you? What does it say about the candidates in terms of their gender choice, their geographic choice, and how they're trying to position themselves as decision makers?
Yeah, I also thought Ben Jealous's choice was interesting, given he has his name recognition, while he's known throughout the state, he's more known nationally among progressives, and he chose someone who is known, Susan Turnbull, who is the former chair of the Democratic Party, somewhat an insider, I would say, in the party. I'm just trying to think of some of the others. I thought it was kind of interesting.
Well, Alec Ross, another Baltimore-based candidate, looks to a business
person. Montgomery County small business owner in Julie Verratti. That's correct. Rich Mattolino has chosen LaWanda Jenkins, who is from Baltimore. He, of course, is from Montgomery County and has chosen a woman from Baltimore, who
and Ms. Jenkins, a former official in the O'Malley administration.
That's right.
So yes. Rich Maddalena really is doubling down on government experience, isn't
yes,
he?
Yes, he is.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, she was LaWanda, or Ms. Jenkins was in the Glendenning, Schaefer, and O'Malley administrations.
Yeah, yeah. So, a long time political analyst. So she knows right. the ropes, to be sure.
I thought the one that was interesting, I know we talked about Brandon Scott, but the fact that Jim Shea chose someone, unlike the others, he chose someone from Baltimore City, you know, I sort of think of him more of based in the city, but I guess that's not necessarily, I think of Jim Shea as being more Baltimore-based.
Yeah, sure.
Tom, I asked him about that and sort of the geographic balance of his ticket the day he announced the selection of Brandon Scott. And he, I think he's technically based in Baltimore County, but, you know, he is a former chair of the University of Maryland Board of Regents.
That's right.
And a variety of other appointed positions in addition to his law firm work. And has been, he likes to point out, around the state. He's not a stranger to the rest of the state.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
I also wanted to mention Irvin, just one other thing that didn't get mentioned that I thought sort of made her sort of more of a standout was the fact that she was
Valerie Irvin, who is now Kevin Kamenetz's choice for lieutenant governor.
Right. Geographically, she's from Montgomery. He's from Baltimore County. But she's also an elected, she's a former county councilwoman as well. So mm-hmm. that sort of speaks to her ability to, I think, get out the vote. And
yeah, again, this ground operation that some of the candidates bring to the tickets. Evita Wiggins, we're going to let you go in a couple of minutes. So before you go, let me ask you about race in this race. We've got Ben Jealous and Rashern Baker, two African-American candidates. There's a theory that says, you know, the two African-American candidates will split that vote and, you know, maybe make a lane for a Jim Shea or a Kevin Kamenetz or anybody else. What's your take on that?
I think there's a strong possibility of that happening. The one thing about Ben Jealous and Rashern Baker, both they're very different. Both of them are black, both black candidates, but they're very different in their style and their approach. Ben Jealous, progressive. I think many would probably describe Rashern Baker more as a moderate. So they are different, even though they both happen to be of the same race. But there is some concern, I think, about the possibility of splitting that vote.
But it will be up to each of them to distinguish themselves quite clearly, not only from the rest of the pack, but from each other.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Evita Wiggins, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for your reporting from Annapolis and elsewhere. We appreciate it, and we'll be in touch as the campaign continues.
Thanks for having me.
And we are going to take a quick break. When we come back from that break, we'll have more political prognostication with William Zorzi of Maryland Matters. By the way, MarylandMatters.com, a terrific addition to the journalistic scene here in Maryland, founded by a guy named Josh Kurtz, and has reporters with the kind of experience that Bill Zorzi, you have. You bring decades of experience covering Maryland politics, and if you haven't,
I'm sorry you pointed that out.
Well, you know, you and I have both we've been around a while, but you know, it's a terrific thing. So if you haven't checked it out, check it out. Maryland Matters. You can find it on the web. Also with me here in Studio A, Dr. Malia Cromer. She's the director of the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center at Goucher College. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about some of the results of their most recent poll. We'd love to hear from you. What do you think about the upcoming gubernatorial races, as well as races in other offices throughout the state of Maryland? 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday_WIPR. We are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around. Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the Worldwide Broadcast, it's the Midday Health Watch with Baltimore Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen. We'll be discussing a few bills that are being considered both locally and statewide, including proposed legislation to implement tough new conditions on the use of Narcan by repeat opioid users. So that's coming up tomorrow here at noon on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we are less than 9 hours away from the filing deadline for people looking to declare their candidacy in this year's June primary elections. As it stands now, there are 7 candidates challenging Governor Hogan for the office of governor. Only one has yet to formally file, Vish Vignaraja has not gone down to the Maryland Commission, Election Commission, and filed for office, but we expect an announcement about her lieutenant governor pick sometime this afternoon, and she, of course, will file officially by 9 o'clock. You are welcome to be part of our conversation today with Malia Cromer and Bill Zorzi. 410-662-8780. That's our phone number, our email, midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. And thanks to our good buddy, Jamila Krimple, we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. So Malia Cromer, just to sort of tie a ribbon around the discussion of lieutenant governor candidates, there is really no job description for the lieutenant governor. I mean, the lieutenant governor exists and has only really existed as an office in our lifetimes. I mean, the last 40 years or so.
Well, I think actually there, for a brief time
Civil War. In the 1800s, right? Yeah. But basically, this job exists to take over if the governor is somehow not able to continue. So does it matter? I mean, in what ways does it matter? Would it matter to any of these candidates who's on the ticket with them?
It matters at the margins, I think. Anytime you have a really close election like this, if it allows a candidate to have a little bit more appeal, a little bit more inroad with a particular geographic kind of demographic or race or gender, or perhaps just any sort of like policy preference, I think that anytime you can make an inroad, even if with a few percentage points, it can matter. That being said, it doesn't matter anywhere near as much as it matters who's at the top of the ticket.
Yeah, and of course, it may matter, Bill Zorzi, a little bit in terms of the ground operations, you know, that one candidate might bring, you know, volunteers, et cetera.
Right, and the ability to raise money is another big factor that I know no one likes to talk about.
How's everybody doing on money so far? I mean, is there a clear leader in that race?
Well, I think the last filing so far this year was the annual filing in January, and Kamenetz was ahead of the game with about $2 million raised.
But like Ben Jealous has about $643,000. Rashern Baker in that ballpark around $700,000. Alec Ross has actually done fairly well for a candidate that a lot of people have never heard of. He's at $445,000 on hand. That's roughly equivalent to Richard Modaleno, who's got about $440,000. So it's interesting.
Well, I think Rich Modaleno has loaned himself some money, if memory serves me, about $139,000. So, and just as we're taking off people who have raised a lot of money, surprisingly, Jim Shea has raised 1.4. So
yeah, so they're all in the hunt, Malia Cromer. But the prognosticators are predicting that Larry Hogan, who's not probably going to face a primary challenge, I mean, somebody may pop up between now and 9 o'clock tonight, but unlikely. He can hold his powder. He doesn't have to spend a dime between now and June 26th. And when June 27th comes around, he could have as much as $10 million in the bank.
And plus probably a significant investment from the Republican Governors Association as well. There's going to be, some outside spending in this race, certainly. But when you look at that percentage of folks who are still undecided for the Democratic primary, you have to couch it in terms of the fact that nobody has put out any real mailers yet or any advertisements on the radio or any TV advertisements. So the people who are engaged in the Democratic gubernatorial election cycle right now seem to be the folks that are apt to show up at a forum. And that is certainly not predictive of the entire Democratic primary electorate. So I think, again, to take a look at these numbers and think about what they'll look like in a few months when some of this money actually gets spent in mass level advertising.
And Bill Zorzi, do we have a situation where money continues to matter in a really big way? I think back to the Baltimore City mayoral election, where you had a candidate, David Warnock, another guy running as an outsider. He was certainly not at all politically consonant with Donald Trump, but he made a very similar argument in terms of his background and experience. He's also a very wealthy individual, and he funded his campaign with, you know, pretty generously, and he didn't really make a dent. I mean, is that kind of anything like that going to translate on the statewide level?
I mean, I think money in and of itself is not. I mean, it's a huge factor. I don't want to underplay it, but it's a common, you know, what makes an attractive candidate to people is, or whether they're forced to think that a candidate is attractive through spending of money, is sort of a combination of factors. You know, money in and of itself is not enough to do it. You know, I mean, people didn't, I don't think, well, I don't want to be, you know, like reinvent the wheel here and go back and revisit the Warnock campaign. But I'm not sure people felt as if they knew who he was. I think race was a factor. I think that there are a variety of other factors in that example.
Yeah, the other thing, Malia, that struck me about the Baltimore City mayoral race and this, whatever analogies may be applicable to the gubernatorial race, is that we had a huge field, 13 candidates at one point, and many of them had not held political office before. But the two leaders from day one until the very last day were the two candidates with the political experience, Sheila Dixon and Catherine Pugh, who was the eventual winner. And I just wonder if you think that may play out the same way, that these other candidates, the Jim Shea, who has, you know, an awful lot of strong support, particularly here in Baltimore. He's got a lot of very wealthy people, frankly, who are behind his candidacy. They think very highly of him as a person who understands the nature of public service, and they think he's doing a really altruistic thing to jump into the end of the fray. I just wonder if political experience in this midterm election that includes Donald Trump as the president, it's a really interesting calculation, isn't it?
Right. So two things, I think. So certainly political experience matters, and it's not just political experience in terms of governance. It's political experience in terms of learning the nuts and bolts of running a campaign, particularly a statewide campaign. It's hard to do this. It's hard to actually get your name recognition up statewide. It's one of, I think, sometimes there's a misjudgment on how hard it is. But I think a secondary point is that, and this is back to the whole Larry Hogan as a quote-unquote outsider, and I completely agree with Bill that he was never an actual real outsider, but he certainly isn't that now. So this is no longer this kind of upstart Republican winning in a blue state. It's now a sitting incumbent governor with a consistently good approval rating, with now outside money and a huge war chest. So for Democrats, turnout will not be enough, right? This whole blue wave won't be enough. They will have to put forward a really strong candidate with some credentials that they can put head-to-head against Larry Hogan's.
And Bill Zorzi, Larry Hogan is the second most popular governor in the United States of America. Interestingly, the first most popular governor is also a Republican who's the head of a Democratic state up in Massachusetts. The top five most popular governors in the United States are all Republicans. There isn't a Democrat even in the top 10. What does that mean? I mean, Hogan is very popular locally, and when you put him up against all the other governors, the other 49, he's very popular nationally, and that, you know, through that prism. What do you make of that, and why do you think that is?
I'm not sure that I can speak to the national question, but so far as Governor Hogan, I think he walks a very fine line. I've said this before in the studio, as a matter of fact. But you know, I think I'm going to start calling him Johnny Cash, really, because he walks a very fine line. Being a Republican in a 2-to-1 Democratic state, and you know, he has to show that all is well, that he's all about bipartisanship. Meanwhile, it doesn't feel to me, as an observer, that the Democratic Party has laid a glove on this guy, and this is not for want of trying. And you know, I think Hogan's operation is very controlled, and I think that they're very aware of the message that is put out there on a regular basis by any member of the administration.
And Malia Cromer, Governor Hogan sat in the very seat that you're sitting in right now 8 days ago and said, when I asked him, for example, about a common Democratic complaint about the governor, is that he takes ideas that the Democrats have introduced, he packages them as his own and says, here's my great idea. They go nuts. And then when it passes, he says, this is a great example of bipartisanship. He is no dummy when it comes to politics.
No, and there's really a fine line.
I thought he was an outsider. right? I'm so confused.
That was then. This is now,
oh,
Bill.
Okay. Yeah, right. Sorry.
No, and there's a fine line between quote unquote stealing somebody's idea and borrowing it, right? And when Democrats point this out a lot, they recently pointed out that it was really, I think it was Senator Mano's idea with the manufacturing tax credits. You heard this was part of their kind of larger conversation. But in pointing it out and shining a light on it, you also highlight to voters that he is willing to adopt Democratic ideas. And when you start to look at our polling, one of the things that shows up a lot is that folks think that Hogan's a moderate. That across the board, even among Democrats, around 50% of Democrats say that Larry Hogan's a moderate. And this kind of moderation is what's buoying his reelection rate and his job approval.
Yeah. We talked a little bit about the lockbox idea that he has casino gambling revenue. And I couldn't help but think of that great Saturday Night Live skit that came out during the campaign that Al Gore had against George W. Bush, where he said, Tipper and I will be the only ones with the key to the lockbox. And then it was Social Security. And, you know, here we have another lockbox. Maggie McIntosh wants to make it a matter of statute, a matter of law, or rather of constitutional amendment, right. Excuse me, constitutional amendment. And the governor and, frankly, Mary Washington want to make it a matter of statute. So you have another Democrat sort of lining up, or the governor lining up with yet another Democratic proposal. Interesting stuff. Okay, we're going to take a little break. We're going to come back and talk a little bit more. William Zorzi is a reporter for Maryland Matters, where he covers state politics. And by the way, a listener has pointed out that Kevin Kamenetz's lieutenant governor running mate, Valerie Ervin, is on the steering committee of Maryland Matters. I didn't know that before I gave it a great endorsement, but it doesn't diminish my endorsement at all of Maryland Matters. Dr. Malia Cromer is a pollster. You didn't know that either, eh, Bill?
I didn't.
This is why people listen to the program. We all learn something.
Thank God.
Dr. Malia Cromer is a pollster. She's an associate professor and director of the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center at Goucher College. We'll take your calls, your emails, your tweets, your comments, your carrier pigeons, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday WIPR. We are live on the WIPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around. We'll be right back. And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we are sizing up the candidates in the 2018 race for Maryland governor and perhaps a couple of other races. The filing deadline with the Maryland Election Commission is 9 o'clock this evening to be on the June 26th primary ballot in our state. Bill Zorzi, a journalist with many decades of experience, as he's loath to be reminded, is with Maryland Matters. He's here in Studio A along with Dr. Malia Cromer, who's a terrific pollster and professor of and director of the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center at Goucher College. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday WIPR. And if it weren't for Jemila Krimple, our good friend and WIPR's digital producer, you would not be able to see all of the festivities happening as we speak live in Studio A. Sounds like something that, you know, Don Pardo should announce. So, Malia Cromer, so here's some common wisdom, which you can now deflate for me, perhaps. And that is that the party in power nationally, which is the Republicans, they own the House. They own the Senate. They own the White House. And many people think that soon they're going to own the Supreme Court. The traditional thinking is that the party in power has a rough time in the midterm elections. There does seem to be an extra dollop of excitement among Democrats nationally. I think I read somewhere, and I haven't checked this out, so this is a rumor until I can exactly check it out, that Emily's List, which tracks women candidates for office, has listed some 26
1,000 women running at the local, the state, and the national level. There's some race somewhere. It's a New Hampshire or something, and I promise listeners I'll figure this out and get it right, where there's two women named Lisa running for the Democratic nomination to be in Congress. I mean, talk about a marketing dilemma there. Does the purported, the putative dissatisfaction with the Republican Party nationally translate statewide? Is that going to matter in the Maryland elections?
Well, it depends, doesn't it? When I look, where does the blue wave go here in Maryland? I think that's the fundamental question. We look at our congressional districts, and there's one that's up for grabs because of redistricting, because of the way the district lines were drawn. The Democrats have drawn some districts that are just really not that competitive, that when it comes after the primary is over, it's going to be over. But the one district, the first district on the Eastern Shore, is the blue wave enough to unseat Andy Harris?
Andy Harris, right.
I don't know.
But you, first of all, believe there's going to be a blue wave nationally?
There is every indicator suggests to me that there are in places that there are competitive elections that Democrats have really focused energy. They've been able to flip seats. I'm not sure the veracity of the wave when it comes here to Maryland. I'm not sure how much outside spending among Democratic and progressive groups will come here to Maryland. I think that there will be an effort for Hogan to lose his seat, but I'm not convinced because, at a congressional level, right now, Ben Cardin, while he is a challenger from within the party, there really doesn't seem to be a substantial Republican challenger on the Senate side. So where is the kind of push and pull? Who do the Democrats want to unseat here in Maryland besides Larry Hogan?
Yeah, Bill Sorcy, what do you think? I mean, nationally, it's not unheard of for the party in power to get walloped in the midterm elections. That may happen with the Republicans nationally. Is it going to matter here? We live kind of in a bubble here in Maryland anyway.
We do. We do, because it is sort of two states in a way. You know, outside of Prince George's, Montgomery, Baltimore County can sort of go either way, and Baltimore City to a lesser degree as each year goes by are sort of Democratic strongholds, and the rest of the state is pretty much a Republican, you know, state.
The population centers, you know, make it a heavily Democratic state because, right, you know, it's something like 9-1 or something. That hasn't changed much during the Hogan administration, right?
Yeah, in Baltimore City, it's 9-1. It's 2-1 statewide, but, you know, it sort of balances out. But I don't see, like, I'm not sure where the wave's going to come in Baltimore, in the state of Maryland, really. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, the State House is clearly up for grabs, but
yeah,
I don't know how much the National Democrats are going to focus on that.
People point to races like Virginia. They had a special election in November of last year, and they flipped that, or pretty close to flipping the state. I mean, it was like literally came down to a flip of a coin, and it remains in Republican control, but hanging by their fingernails, Malia.
But where are the seats to flip in the Maryland General Assembly? Mm-hmm. And that's the question. So yes, they flipped a lot of seats in Virginia, and they might have been more competitive. I'm not an expert on Virginia politics, but my guess is they might have a little bit more competitive districts drawn than we do have them here in Maryland. And so I guess that's – you look at those Republican districts here in Maryland, and you have to ask yourselves, first, did a Democrat actually file to run against some of these incumbent Republicans? And in some cases, there has not been a Democratic challenger to file. If that's the case, when you redistrict in a gerrymander, oftentimes it gives you an advantage, but it also creates districts in which you can't win.
Yeah, of course, redistricting is one of the issues that Governor Hogan has identified as something he wants to change. He's got a bill. Mike Bush, not at all interested in that bill. So we'll see where that plays out. Paul in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call. You're on with Malia Cromer and Bill Sorcy.
Great. I just wanted to go back to the issue of the lieutenant governor choice, and I kind of wonder why they have to choose the lieutenant governor so early instead of after they've won the primary. That's not how it's done in a presidential election. Twice in recent history, we've had weak lieutenant governors run for governor, and that's why we've had two Republican governors in the in recent history.
Yeah, in the last 25 years. Bill Sorcy, what do you think? I mean, as Malia was saying, you know, it may affect voters on the margins, but does it Do Democrats maybe make the calculation, well, I wouldn't want this person to be the lieutenant governor because that means she or he will run the next time and lose? That seems like a pretty pessimistic view of the world.
That is a fairly cynical view. I think it's perfect. No, I don't to answer the guy's question, I don't know the reason that they're required by law to select their lieutenant governor candidate ahead of time, if you will. Mm-hmm. They have not been the strongest and best candidates. The two recent lieutenant governors who have
And Paul brings up a good point. Of course, there are some states that do open primaries. I mean, and look what that means for somebody like Dianne Feinstein in California, who's not received the endorsement of the state Democratic Party. But if she's, a top vote getter and not the person who's challenging her, the Democrats there who may not want her to go back to the Senate are going to be, as it were, stuck with her. I do want to talk about one other race, Bill Zorzi, and that's the race for Nathaniel Oakes's seat. He is a senator from representing the city who is under indictment. His trial will begin after the session is finished in April. But there seems like to be a pretty open race there. But a pretty prominent name has decided not to enter that fray just last week. Sheila Dixon.
That was Sheila Dixon. But
former mayor of Baltimore, also indicted and removed from office during her term.
I was just trying to compare offenses, actually, in my mind, and allegations. Oakes represents West Baltimore, and he has a challenger in J.D. Merrill, who was a first-timer, who was also Martin O'Malley's son-in-law, as I understand.
Young guy, 27 years old, first venture into politics.
Right. And I believe Jill Carter has...
Emily, I think you have found out that has happened just today. I mean, as we said, today is the filing deadline. So Jill Carter left the legislature to go work in the Pew administration here in Baltimore City. Looks like she's looking to get back into the fray.
A profile in courage, no doubt. Today's the last day, as you have pointed out, but also last night, the Senate president stripped Senator Oakes of his seat on the Finance Committee, which is a powerful committee, based on this federal indictment. And he has two trials, by the way, coming up.
Yeah, that's true.
So
we'll have to see what happens there. We have a comment on Facebook from Tiffany, who says, I just wanted to say that although it's conventional knowledge that lieutenant governor picks usually don't sway voters, I have to admit that I looked at Rashearn Baker for the first time because of his pick of Elizabeth Embry. And as you said, Malia Croma, Elizabeth Embry picked up a lot of goodwill during her race for mayor a couple of years ago.
Yeah, so it might matter on the margins.
Yeah, interesting.
I'd like to know where Tiffany lives, actually, if she could write back and me know.
Well, if she's outside of Baltimore, that would be even more interesting, I think.
It would be.
To think about what that is. Well, there's one other race. I mean, this is Mary Washington challenging Senator Joan Carter Conway. There are folks in the Legislative Black Caucus that are maybe not so hot on this idea of a delegate challenging a senator who sits on a powerful committee, the Education Committee. What do you make of that? Malia Cromer, do you have any thoughts about that? Or Bill, what do you think? We just got a minute left here.
I think Mary Washington has an uphill fight against Joan Carter Conway, who is the chair of the Senate Education, Health, and Environmental Affairs. Mary Washington is a second-term delegate from the 43rd or Northeast Baltimore, and I think that's it's going to be a tough run. Joan ran the last time challenged by Bill Henry, who was a city councilman, and she got about 10,000 votes, and he got about 5,000, roughly. Mary Washington ran third in the House of Delegates, mm-hmm. Behind Maggie McIntosh and Kurt Anderson. So I'm not sure that shows.
But it ain't scaring her off. So we will follow that and all of the other races. And Malia, you and I have spent more than one election night together. And so perhaps we'll do that again in June. And we appreciate both of you guys showing up this afternoon. And we will stay in touch as the race continues. Appreciate it. Bill Zorzi is a journalist with millennia of experience covering Maryland politics. He writes for Maryland Matters. Dr. Malia Cromer is an associate professor and director of the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center at Goucher College. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, Dr. Lena Wen joins us for another edition of the Midday Health Watch. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. There's pizza for everybody, Malia and Bill, I promise. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Have a good day.